Blog Talk Radio.
All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Yaron and Amy Show. Hey, Amy, how's it going?
It's going okay, Yaron, but you know, I think we're going to have to give up this whole show. We're not going to be able to do.
No, we're not going to be able to do it.
Podcast anymore? Yeah.
Yeah. How come?
Well, let me make sure that I get the name right because you know I don't want to misrepresent anything over here. JA565HR.
Oh, he's
on YouTube.
Yeah.
He tells us that we have killed objectivism. You know how we did that?
By talking about pineapples.
We talked about pineapple on pizza for a few minutes, you know, made a joke about something.
Yeah.
And in fact, someday I'm going to defer it, but we'll have a bigger discussion that there's actually some substantive issue here to be discussed.
There's an epistemological issue about how you define food groups, but
not just that.
But
anyway,
we'll defer the discussion. Yes.
But you know, the whole joking actually is giving rise to some substantive discussions there. But no, we have killed objectivism by joking about pineapple pizza, which the whole world does, by the way. It's not just objectivists, right? Everybody jokes about this stuff. But now we have killed it. So I think we should just close up shop.
No.
You don't think objectivism dies that easily, huh?
No, and I think we can probably go through. We've done this in the past. We can probably go through 2-3 years of shows without mentioning pineapple again.
We probably could.
Yeah, I think so. And enrich the world in the process. Maybe not enrich it quite as much as if we included pineapple
again,
in the discussion.
A future show, there is actually some substance to this issue. We'll talk about it. Okay? Okay.
All right. We'll do a whole show on the substance behind pizza.
The other thing, of course, is a meta discussion, right? Because this is just joking for a couple minutes, and you're not allowed to do this on a podcast where people are having.
How many people took this idiot seriously? I mean, obviously, some people are stupid. So.
No, nobody did, but it's the death of objectivism.
I've killed objectivism many, many times over.
According to the wisdom of YouTube, right?
Yes.
The wisdom
of
YouTube
Twitter,
comments.
Facebook, I think I've killed objectivism.
So JA565HR, I just want to tell you that if you want objectivism to be killed, you're going to have to wait for the extinction of the whole entire human race, which of course is the topic of today's show.
Yep. Yeah.
The extinction of the human race, right? This is what we're in the business of contemplating now, seriously, out there in the culture, is whether it would be a good thing for the entire human race to go extinct.
Well, would it be a tragedy? So it's not bad uniformly. It's tragedy, which means bad, but there's some good, I guess. It's sad that it's bad, right? That's what tragedy means.
It's sad, but it's not a complete tragedy is the idea. Is that where we are right now?
No, I think what he's saying is that So let's give the context, right? There is an editorial in the leading newspaper of the land, still, the New York Times, an editorial by a philosopher, nonetheless, a philosopher from, I'm not allowed to say this, but actually from Clemson University, which embarrasses me to no end because I'm on a board of directors of the Institute for Capitalism at Clemson, and I've spent many, 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 many days at Clemson having a good time and lecturing and teaching and meeting with people and talking to students, and this philosophy professor from Clemson University writes this op-ed in the New York Times and gets it published. It's hard to get published in the New York Times. It's not easy to get an op-ed published by any newspaper, and certainly not by the New York Times. Anyway, the title of this op-ed is, "Would Human Extinction Be a Tragedy? Would it be a bad thing?" And not purely bad. Would it be tragedy is also self-caused usually. So would we be causing this bad thing? But then he also goes into a whole discussion of whether it would be a bad thing. Put aside the tragedy, whether it would be bad for the human race to be extinct. And I think I think the conclusion of the piece is, no, it wouldn't be bad for the human race to be extinct, but it would be tragic. It would be kind of sad, but not bad. So you would there'd be a little bit element of regret, but overall, it's good that the human race is going to be extinct.
Yeah. So my inspiration, of course, for a title was
All right. Where
imagine
is
all
I
the people.
I have it here. One of the greatest melodies ever, right? This is such a beautiful song. If you can mute out some of the lyrics, right? I'm not sure we're allowed to play this, but it's on YouTube. It's, I guess, public domain. But if you can blank out some of the lyrics and keep some of the others, it's actually a gorgeous melody, right?
Now I have a link below to this in the program notes so people can get it.
John Lennon at his best musically, but he was a commie. So he was for the extinction of the human race.
Now, in there, he doesn't say,
but he says, imagine there's no money. We know what that would lead to, where there's no money.
Right.
I mean, the consequence.
They think at least, and this is part of the reason that I like using, imagine all the people gone. Because as wrong as Lenin was,
yes, he's nowhere near as evil as these bastards.
He's not as nihilistic as what we're reading in this op-ed, which is taking seriously whether it would be, and I start out, whether it would be a good thing, saying there it's plausible to argue that it might be good for all human beings to be gone. And that's really the premise here. Now, it's like, he's talking in terms, is it tragedy? Is it bad? Whatever. But the flip side and the question is they're asking us to seriously consider whether that would be a good thing.
Yeah, he's saying the elimination of the human species would be a good thing, full stop, if not for, and then he goes into the one value the human beings actually have. But imagine is perfect for this. And I'm not suggesting John Lennon was a nihilist. He wasn't. He was just kind of a commie, drugged out. I think a brilliant musicians. I think he wrote some of the best Beatles lyrics. I think the Beatles are still, if not the greatest rock band in history, certainly up there among the greatest, maybe the greatest, with some great music and great music that John Lennon wrote. So he was an amazing musician, but he was a socialist. He was a crazy. Imagine there's no money. I mean, but that's not what these people are. These are not people that are about some communist dream. Because what is their standard, Amy? What's the standard? So for most philosophers, until the last maybe 50 years, the standard has always been something, either God or something, but even when it's God, it's usually as it relates to human beings, right?
Yes.
So it could be the good of society, but a society of humans. It could be the good of the individual. That's very rare, but that happens, right? With Aristotle, maybe Spinoza, certainly Ayn Rand.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some sects in which it's the good of God in some pure form, or the good of the fewer in some good, pure form. But even then, God as presented to us in a human form as Jesus, right? It has to be human. I think really for the first time in human history, we're supposed to sacrifice to what?
Animals.
Well, yeah. Animals, but really his standard
not even
is
just animals, nature and
the world, right?
Ecosystem,
yeah.
Right?
He asks, is the world going to be a better place?
Yeah, I got a reaction to this on Twitter from one of my followers, and let me read this to you. And this is all public stuff. So this was Joel who wrote to me, and I was actually going to copy it in the program notes. So maybe I should have done that, right?
Yeah.
He says humans are funny, always thinking they're more significant than their ecosystem. And that's the idea now, is that the good is not to be measured by anything in relation to human beings, either what it is that God wanted for us or, heaven forbid, anything that we think is of value for ourselves, you know, using humans themselves as a standard of value, can't do that. What you've got to do instead is you have to look at either animals and the suffering that they're capable of, or forget even suffering, right? And that's one thing he talks about a lot in here, is the amount of suffering caused, right? So there's a certain amount of suffering that would take place if all human beings were to go extinct, but look at all of the suffering that we're causing to the animal species out there.
Yeah, so there's, so I think this, the reason we're talking about this article is I think it's really, first of all, it's reflective of many of the problems within the environmentalist movement. And
there are some libertarians that I'm sure hear it, right? Sure.
But it's very philosophical in the sense that I think it's reflective of some of the issues that are being discussed and the way they're being discussed in philosophy departments. So I thought it would be interesting from those perspectives. So let's take this a few lines at a time. So he asked this question, whether it would be a tragedy if the planet no longer contained human beings. Now, what should be the first question that should pop into your mind when a question like that is asked? Whether it would be a tragedy if the planet no longer contained human beings, what should be the question?
And let me give you the questions that I gave right back to Joel there on Twitter, right? A tragedy for whom? I said, yeah. You know, significant. Uh-huh. Significant for whom? And for what, right? So, who's evaluating this tragedy from what perspective?
And if there are no human beings, and he actually talks about this later on, if there are no human beings, then who's it a tragedy for? And is nature capable of valuing? Is nature capable of conceiving of tragedy? Is nature capable of feeling? Nature, qua nature. No, none of those things. There is no values outside the experiences of individual human beings. There is no valuing outside the value systems of individual human beings. So Ayn Rand always said, whenever you hear a question related to is this good or is this bad? Or is this a value? Is this a tragedy? Is this to whom?
Yes.
And for what?
Yes.
Right. Those are always the questions you have to, and you ask him, and he never, I mean, it's so obvious to ask that question. It's the first thing that pops in his mouth. And I don't think just an objectivist, anybody, he just takes it for granted that we understand that the planet, nature, the ecosystem, whatever you want to do, has some intrinsic value above and beyond what we as human beings give it, that there's some value in and of itself. And whether human beings or not, you can evaluate based on this other standard external to human beings, which is...
You know what? I wonder if it was Rawls, the egalitarian Rawls, that teed up this sort of analysis. And of course, if Greg Salmeri was here, he could tell you the origin. But I was making the connection between this, this sort of essay that asks you to evaluate whether this is a tragedy apart from any particular human being and their hierarchy of values or anything else. Is it a tragedy? And Rawls, remember, Rawls had the idea that we could decide the optimal rules for society from behind the so-called veil of ignorance. And so what we were supposed to do, if we were going to decide what the best rules for society or the fair rules for society were, as your own, you and I would sit there and we'd say, okay, let's set aside all of our particular characteristics, our hierarchy of values, right? Everything else, and just try to, quote, rationally and objectively evaluate what would be fair rules to govern society. And here he's basically saying, let's do the veil of ignorance, but not just among human beings like Rawls would talk about, but let's do it between the ecosystem and the animals, the rocks, whatever, and human beings. And that somehow there's going to be a veil of ignorance that you can, stand behind that doesn't even let you be a human being in the equation.
I mean, I don't know if Rawls is the first to originate such analysis, but yeah, the kind of analysis to analyze values independent of human beings, independent of people actually ranking those values, actually having those values, it strikes me probably it's probably goes back before Rawls, although Rawls gives it this original spin with the veil of ignorance. But of course, there's always been this idea of intrinsic value. this idea that the value is in the thing. It's not in our estimation of the thing. It's in the thing. And it's, of course, we don't believe in subjective values either. It doesn't mean that any value you have is a value. Anything you want is truly a value. You know, the standard has to be individual human life, according to Ayn Rand. So there's an objectivity to it. There's objective standard by which you can measure whether a value is value. All right, so I'm just going over his essay because I think it's interesting. Hopefully the audience does too. One of the questions for him is it tragic? And the issue of tragedy is, he says, tragic character is often someone who commits a wrong, usually a significant one, and suffers the consequences of it, but with whom we feel sympathy in their descent. So I think he's trying to say human extinction, he's for human extinction, but he believes it's a tragedy, so he feels sympathy in that it's going to happen. So he's a little saddened by it, even though he thinks it's a good thing. Now, why should humanity disappear? Why? What is it that human beings are doing that is so bad? And he names three things, although his entire focus is on one, which is interesting, and I think goes to...
So the idea is that there are certain wrongs that human beings inherently are guilty of.
Yes.
And in order to eliminate those wrongs from the world, these damaging, destructive wrongs from the world, we'd have to eliminate the whole human species.
And he's right, because as we'll see, he identifies the wrongs as... He identifies the wrongs as things that are essential for human survival, human existence, human flourishing. So his identification is of those things that are essentially human, that if you take them away, human beings cannot survive. They cannot, human beings just die if you take away our capacity basically to change our environment to suit ourselves. We're the only animal that doesn't sit around waiting for our genes to change so we can adapt our environment, but that actually adapts our environment to suit us. So in that sense, we're the only animal, the only species that, because we have free will and reason, we have the capacity to actually change the environment to fit our needs. And that's what he finds offensive. And once you take that away from human beings, we will go extinct. Extinct. If you eliminate reason, we will go extinct, right? We will disappear as a species because it's our means of survival. Just like if you take away...
Well, I mean, we could say it a little bit differently, right? So we could say if you eliminate the ability to change our environment on the basis of the judgment of our rational faculty, then pretty soon you would end up eliminating reason because there'd be no outlet for reason to operate. And yeah.
Yeah, although he thinks reason is good for a few things. So here are the things that our sins, our great sins that justify our extinction. First, climate change, which is devastating ecosystems. What does that even mean? Are asteroids really, really evil because they devastate ecosystems? Was the Ice Age? I wonder if he thinks the Ice Age was evil because it devastated ecosystems. What about climate change that's happened for millennia and that has caused species to extinct and deserts to become forests and forests to become deserts? And which one of those is good and which one of those is bad? And do we care? I think the key there is that everything untouched by human beings, anything that happens in nature untouched by human beings is the good. And any human intervention is the bad because...
Right. Or you could say, yeah, those other things are bad too. Like he'd say to you, Yaron, those other things are bad too. However, we have a choice about whether we inflict the bad things on the world. We can just choose to not inflict all this.
I think he would say it was bad.
Yeah. I mean, he could, because I mean, if he's going to take
what the standard
that,
would be.
That kind of impartial perspective, then I think maybe he'd say, well, those things are bad, but you know, the Ice Age doesn't have a choice and this and that doesn't have a choice. But look, we have a choice about whether or not we're going to bring about this horrific climate change.
Yeah. So Anshul is asking a related question. Wesley, I'll get to your question later. He's saying, so then the difference between intrinsic value and objective metaphysical value is that the latter is the best value for man. Are you hearing like an echo? No? Okay.
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay. So, no, the difference is that intrinsic value is the value of something in and of itself. It's in the thing. It has value whether there is a valuer or not. It just has value. So objectivism holds there's no such thing as intrinsic value. Nothing has a value in and of itself. All value.
Not even human beings, which is interesting, right? Because he talked about at the headline that the human race has inherent value.
Yes.
But really, the value depends on human beings recognizing and embracing the value too. So it's not even inherent.
Right? That's right. So human beings are value to a human being. But there's nothing else to value human beings. And human beings do not have an intrinsic value. Nothing has an intrinsic value. And according to objectivism, all values, all legitimate values are objective values. That is, there has to be a valuer for whom it's rationally good for them, this thing that they value.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Right. So, intrinsic value doesn't exist as a philosophical concept. Now, we talk about it in finance and in, you know, there's a lot of context in which it comes up, but it's not a legitimate term, not qua philosophical, philosophical term. So objectivism rejects, just like it rejects subjective value, right, as being a legitimate value, right?
Yes, yes. Subjective meaning it's just held by the consciousness of some human, but there's no basis in the real world that lines up with it.
Now, if there were aliens, then the aliens could have value, and they could say the aliens could say human beings are value to us or not. They could say the Earth is a value to us, because they want to use it or whatever. But they would have to be reasoning beings to be mm-hmm. able to say that, to be able to have a value. But given that, for all intents and purposes, there are no aliens, and since we don't know, even if they are, we don't know them, and there's no way to care one way or the other, then it's irrelevant. It's irrelevant. The aliens are irrelevant to the discussion. Okay, so the first is climate change. The second is an increasing human population is encroaching on ecosystems. Again, this ecosystems, the sanctity of ecosystems. And of course, any increase in human population encroaches on ecosystems. Any, even a human population increasing from 100 to 200, is now 100 people encroaching on an ecosystem they didn't encroach on before. So there's an ever expanding human race is a problem if ecosystems have a value separate from human beings. But if you value, we'll get to this, if you value human life, right? If your standard of value is human life, then the question is encroaching and devastating ecosystem a good thing or a bad thing? Maybe devastating certain ecosystems is a good thing. Like, I'll give you an example. I think a couple of shows ago, I said that my wife and I were out and we got bitten by these evil creatures, not quite mosquitoes. I don't know what they are exactly.
Like sand mites or something.
Yeah, and they attack you in hordes, and it's much more powerful of a bite than a mosquito. So you get 20, 30 of these, and they're much more powerful, and they don't go away, and normal drugs don't work. And anyway, I would love to devastate that ecosystem. I would love to make those little creatures extinct. I think human life would be substantially better. That's my standard. And then the third, which is the third reason why he thinks human beings are such a evil thing, is the one he really keeps repeating over and over again throughout the piece, and really the thing that really resonates with him. And this he gets from all over modern philosophy, primarily Peter Singer's work. Peter Singer is probably the most well-known ethicist today. And that is the idea that factory farms create and then slaughter and create suffering and misery for millions and millions and millions and millions of animals. And it, And this is the thing you have to understand about modern ethics, or at least the school of modern ethics. The standard of value, intrinsic value, is lack of suffering. So the ideal is no suffering. That is the good. Evil is suffering. Suffering of any being capable of feeling pain. Any being capable of suffering. It's all the same. So human suffering, animal suffering, mice suffering. Mice can feel pain. Any animal that has consciousness and has a nervous system that can feel pain, their suffering matters. That's why people like Peter Singer, people like Sam Harris. Sam Harris shares this moral code, by the way. Sam Harris talks about this. The standard for morality is suffering. If something you do causes suffering,
that's the starting point for ethics for Peterson as well, right? Peterson talks in his book about suffering. Elimination of suffering is good, and that's the starting point for him.
Although he doesn't give an intrinsic value, and he doesn't include animals in the scope of suffering. Right.
Right. I don't remember him talking about
beings.
The animals, whereas Singer would talk about animals.
And so does Pinker. So does Steven
Pinker.
Like
the bacon I ate before the show today.
Yeah. Like Pinker, Harris, Singer, and now this guy, they all talk about the standard of evil is suffering. And the alleviation of suffering is what is good. And suffering across all beings. Again, losing the fact that I'm a human being. My standard of value is me. And there's a reason why I value other human beings. And there's a reason why I value chickens for food. Chickens are food. And if I can extract that food more efficiently through industrial farming, then great. Then that's a good thing, not a bad thing. Right? So the whole basis here is we inflict suffering. And since we inflict suffering, right, he says humanity then is the source of devastation of the lives of conscious animals on a scale that is difficult to comprehend. And he said if that was the only consideration, then the elimination of the human species would be a good thing, full stop. Right? That's it. Mm-hmm. And this is the conclusion you have to come to. This is the conclusion Peter Singer has to come to, and they all have to come to if that is their standard. I think Sam Harris has to come to if that is truly their standard for what is good. Right? And
but he says, no. So you have to balance it with
But we have to balance this out to the fact that human beings, what they bring, notice again the intrinsicism, what they bring to the planet that animals can't. Like the planet is the standard. The planet is, you know, this is Gaia, the Earth Mother, and we bring things to her. So we're this vicious, horrible creature that creates all the suffering. But we also bring to Mother Earth certain values. What are the values that we bring to Mother Earth? Science and literature and painting and music. And all of this is balanced against the suffering we inflict. Now notice, who exactly benefits from the music and the literature and the painting and the science? Mother Earth? Does Mother Earth value this? Is this a value outside of human beings?
Right, exactly. I mean, he shifts his standard of evaluation, right?
Yep.
So from the other perspective, he doesn't say, okay, you know, what is climate change? What is the ecosystem? What is the animal suffering that we cause? How do we evaluate those from the human perspective? Right? He doesn't say that. He just tries to do some sort of, you know, impartial observer, non-conscious perspective or something. And then when he's going to say, well, why it would be a tragedy, he's going to talk about the things that are good for us. And he doesn't, you know, he doesn't let you know that he's switching his standard of evaluation from one that doesn't take the perspective of human beings to one that necessarily does, because we're the only ones who are capable of appreciating these things that he lists. And pretty sure he's.
And he knows that's a problem because he has two paragraphs trying to deal with it, but he can't, of course, he can't deal with it. So at the end of the day, he says, look, I think, I'm not going to commit to this. I think, you know, this is typical, again, I think, of modern philosophers, that they don't want to commit. I think, because it's complex, but I think the extinction of the human race would be a good thing, but it would be a tragedy. We would have some regret. I don't know who we are, whoever's left around. But then it gets to an interesting question in this. If that's true, should we all commit suicide? Right? Should we all commit suicide? He also says, he has this interesting, you know, before that, he also has this interesting thing about where he says, yeah, I mean, painting is beautiful, but how many lives is it worth? This I found interesting, by the way. So he says, suppose a terrorist planted a bomb in the Louvre, and the first responders had to choose between saving people and saving the art. What would you save? Or he says, how many human lives would it be worth sacrificing to preserve the existence of Shakespeare's work? Now, this is interesting, partially because this is an experiment that actually has been run. It's fascinating to me that human beings have given up their lives, have risked their lives to save works of art because they understood the value of those works of art and they understood what kind of world they would be living in if those works of art were eliminated from that world.
Right, okay. And so you're saying that people have chosen to risk their lives for the sake of important works of art. Okay, sure. But notice what he's doing, right? He's doing the very typical academic philosopher who teaches the intro philosophy class trick, which is he's throwing at you what Ayn Rand called the ethics of emergency.
So this is the trolley.
The trolley sort of thing, right? But, you know, so you're going to ask questions about how human beings normally on planet Earth should live. And you're going to try to answer them by engaging in hypothetical scenarios that involve a choice between two horrible things that normally aren't happening, right? This is an emergency. This is a once in a very long, I mean, it's horrible. It happened in Brazil recently, right?
Yeah.
But most of the time, human beings are not going to create principles of ethics based on the idea that at any moment they're going to be confronting choices between themselves and the Mona Lisa or whatever, right?
But it doesn't matter, right? Because he already knows what the standard is. The standard is suffering. And his point is, all these good things that human beings create, all these good things that human beings produce, are nothing, nothing as compared to the suffering we inflict on animals. That is, And he's trying to say, when it comes to human beings, it's obvious, right? You would save the human beings. You wouldn't save the paintings. That's obvious. But we're okay with sacrificing millions and millions and millions of cows and chickens so that we can have a Shakespeare, so we can have a Louvre. And my answer, of course, is yeah. I get much more value out of. I'd be willing to sacrifice. I'd be willing to kill, even if it meant great suffering to them, every chicken in the world in order to save the Louvre Museum or in order to save Michelangelo's David. Every single chicken would go, right? And that's a major real human giving up something because we wouldn't have anything to eat. We wouldn't have chickens to eat. We'd have to eat something else. But the chicken doesn't come into my moral consideration because my moral standard is my life. My moral standard is what is good for human beings, qua human beings. And our lives is better for having Michelangelo. Chickens, it's a little better, but nothing compared to the Louvre, right? Nothing compared to. So, yeah, I mean, we're weighing values constantly based on what? We have the standard. Standard is not suffering of all sentient beings. The standard is my life. Why should I care about the suffering of a chicken? Indeed, I don't. Now, if somebody
other things being equal, you would like to avoid the suffering of chickens.
Yeah,
sure.
because they're not alive and there's value to life, and it's more the idea that somebody is inflicting pain on chickens for the sake of inflicting pain. Somebody being cruel to animals for the sake of being cruel says something about that person. But I wouldn't pass a law to stop him. I would just treat him like the nasty human being he is. Mm-hmm. But it's not so much that I care about the chicken as much as I care about what kind of person tortures chickens. You know, that's more the issue. And if torturing chickens is necessary in order to bring food to my table, I'm cool with torturing chickens.
Yeah, if that's the way that it has to be done.
I think that's a nice soundbite, right? You're on cool torturing chickens. Somebody's gonna do that, right? You can do
tortured
a clip
chickens
on YouTube.
For breakfast.
Chickens. Suffering chickens. So chickens that suffered for breakfast. Mm. All right, you see.
I mean, I think yeah. you give the answer though too is that human beings are sometimes willing to risk even their own lives, not necessarily sacrifice their own lives, but for great works of art.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Because mm-hmm. what would life be in a world that was destroying great works of art? I mean, imagine what it would have been like, I mean, to be in ancient Rome and watch the barbarians destroy all those sculptures, or watch the Christians, because the Christians were the worst of all. The Christians destroy all the great sculptures of Rome. I mean, when you go to Athens and you hear about what the Christians did to Greek art and how they destroyed those one-of-a-kind marble sculptures or the great reliefs or the paintings that existed, and they just smashed them. They just had they saw no value in them. They were of no value in the country. They were disvalues because they were pagan, and they just crushed them. You know, maybe, you know, given how much I love art, maybe that gives you a little bit of a sense of why I hate Christianity so much. You know, it's just despicable what they did, but, you know, and imagine being there, and I can imagine there were Greeks or Romans trying to save that art. And if you can read about stories during World War II of incredibly brave people, incredible people who valued life, who valued beauty, who valued art, who risked their lives to save pieces of art. It, as the Nazis approached and they knew the art would be stolen, hid it, mm-hmm. protected it. There's actually a really good movie with Burt Lancaster, mm-hmm. Called The Train. It's slow. Many of you won't like it, but it's about a train full of art from, I think, the Louvre or a major French museum, and the Germans about to cart it off and, you know, store it in a mountain and the resistance spends a huge amount of effort to save this train. It's a really clever movie. It's a good movie. So people will risk their lives to save paintings in the Louvre. Absolutely. There's some sculptures in the Louvre that, you know, that I know I would. And, you know, Leonard, do you remember Leonard, Dying Slave? Michelangelo's Dying Slave is in the mm-hmm. Louvre. And,
yeah.
You know, Leonard has described that with great emotion, that sculpture, and, you know, the value to him and what that represents. So, there's some magnificent artworks, and they mean a lot to you as an individual. I wouldn't expect somebody else to risk their lives who didn't value those sculptures. If somebody said, I don't get anything from this, I would never expect them to risk their lives for the sculpture. It would have to be somebody who it meant something to.
One of the beautiful things about human beings. We have those different options. But, you know, this guy, you know, he's sitting back. Oh, it seems like a live possibility that we would be better off just all killing ourselves
yes.
for the sake of preventing continued animal suffering. He says, it seems like a live possibility, and that by itself disturbs me. So we're supposed to give him credit for depth and profundity or something because
I've read a lot of stories like this. I know.
And it disturbs him.
It disturbs him. He's upset by it. Well, he's suffering, so we should alleviate the suffering. I mean, the reason we're talking about this, I mean, this is some wacky philosopher. He's nuts. This is stupid. This is even on his own terms. This goes all over the place and logically inconsistent. But this is typical. So a few, a year or two ago, I did a show about people who say we shouldn't have children for this same reason. And again, mm-hmm. I've seen lots of articles discussing exactly the same thing, where the standard of value is this idea of suffering. Plus, this is a standard value for, again, very influential people like Sam Harris, like Steven Pinker, like Peter Singer. And it has to be, we have to challenge this, you know, and only Ayn Rand has a real challenge to them. Now, I don't know how prevalent this is within philosophy departments. I see it a lot in the public because I think it makes for good op-eds. it riles people up. It gets people excited. So I'm not surprised somebody like the New York Times would publish this. I think I think it's important to understand that this is in our philosophy departments. This is legitimate, viewed as legitimate stuff that's going on, this contemplating the end of humanity, all based on the idea of suffering as the standard. But I think the other thing that's really important here to understand is that this is the philosophy at the end of the day that underlies environmentalism, that underlies the entire environmentalist movement. They're not interested in human beings. They're not interested in human values. Now, again, I'm not saying every environmentalist is a nihilist like this guy is, because he is a nihilist. I mean, this philosophy is ultimately motivated by hatred and loathing and wanton destruction. But it's rationalized through this bullshit around suffering. And I shouldn't say it's bullshit because you know, that makes it too minor. This is a major philosophical issue right now, unfortunately. But it is bullshit because it's shallow and silly. But it's just a rationalization. It's a rationalization for the hatred. It's a rationalization for the nihilism. It's a rationalization for the hatred of the human race and just want the joy in destruction, the joy in death, and contemplating death, right? In thinking that you're sophisticated because you think it's a tragedy and it's not just a simple let's just wipe out the human race. But this is what motivates the environmentalists, and for those this is what motivates the intellectual environmentalists, the philosophical environmentalists, and to a large extent this is why I can't take climate change too seriously. I don't make claims about the science of climate change. I don't know it. I've never dug into the numbers. I've never, you know, I complain when other people don't do economics. I don't do climate science. I don't know it, so I shouldn't comment on it.
Right.
What I can comment is the motivation. And if this is the motivation of a significant number of the intellectuals behind the movement, then I'm suspicious of the science, not because I know anything about the science, but because I know that philosophy will distort and pervert everything you touch if you hold this kind of philosophy.
No, and it's, again, it's what is the standard by which they're judging the goodness, the badness, whether something is a tragedy or not, etc. It's not by the rational well-being of human beings, right? It's not us.
No, because if it was, then we would realize that slaughtering millions and millions and millions of chickens and cows actually makes possible the lives of billions of human beings, and it makes life expectancy much longer than it is today, that industrial farming has allowed for a rise in the standard of living, quality of life, and length of life of human beings. Even if you believe in paleo and we should be only eating grass-fed beef, the fact is most people can't afford to eat grass-fed beef, mm-hmm. and even eating hormones, beef with hormones or whatever unnatural thing you think they are eating, still improves their lives relative to the alternative, which is no beef, right? So I'd rather have them. Even if and that goes for GMOs, and that goes for all of the food that actually enhances human life if your standard is human beings.
I mean, I think there's a certain type of orientation, ideological orientation of people who wants to focus on the importance of suffering, right? And you know, as human beings, there has been a lot of suffering up until the recent past. And I guess that's what Pinker has written about, right? That we have been so good at figuring out ways to minimize human suffering. That is one thing that the ingenuity of human beings has been able to do. And so now philosophers, human suffering has been minimized to a large extent. Let's start to focus on animal suffering, and let's start to focus on suffering that doesn't even exist, but projected imaginary suffering of ecosystems and climate, you know.
And Pinker talks about that. He talks about the fact that now that we've solved much of human suffering, the next great frontier is to expand rights to include animals and to give animal rights and eliminate suffering. So he is on this project of it. So he would counter this op-ed by saying, oh, no, you're being too pessimistic. We can build a world in which animals don't suffer. And I'm saying, no. You have to choose here. Animals or their ecosystem the only way human beings survive is by changing their environment. The environment cannot stay the same, whatever the hell that even means.
I mean, what is true is that the, you know, more ingenuity that we exercise to make our lives better and better and better, we will end up having extra wealth that we can devote to, for instance, grass-fed beef killed in the humanest way and the, you know, whatever.
Or better, artificial beef. How about artificial beef? GMO beef that we grow.
That kind of stuff still irks me. I don't know.
I'm excited about beef that doesn't even come from animals that they grow in
little
a lab.
Little petri dish beef. You go right ahead.
Petri dish beef with marbled just right, just the right amount of fat, just the right amount of flavor.
Wow.
I mean, yeah, I know this is more radical than pineapple and pizza, but yeah, I'm a foodie, right? I love molecular. You know, if you can take food and change it, or you can create new food, I'm cool with that. I'm excited.
We'll put it in the same discussion as the pineapple on pizza someday, because I sense there's some kind of real issue that is behind my squeamishness, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
We'll see. Okay.
One day, let's be clear. One day, there's no question, because they're already working on it, and there's already some good prototypes.
Yeah.
One day, beef will be grown in a petri dish.
Soylent green.
But it won't be Soylent green. That's the beauty of it.
No.
You won't have to use any kind of animal, even human beings. You'll be able to actually grow it in a petri dish and eat it. And we're not talking about cannibalism. We're not talking about human. We're talking about just taking molecules and turning them into beef. And you would say it's not beef because it didn't come from a cow, but it's beef.
There's going to be something different about it. It's going to be the difference between, are you ready?
Yep.
Here's my analogy, vinyl and digital music. There's going to be something like that.
Vinyl is better.
Sorry.
I accept
this is
that
my brain.
Vinyl is
my
better.
Brain
however,
analogies
however, the what do you call it? Convenience of digital music far surpasses the difference in
and the convenience of petri dish beef. Oh yeah,
absolutely, absolutely. You could grow it. You can grow it in your 3D printer at home. You'd have a 3D printer at home. I mean, you're laughing. But
I thought of a use for a 3D printer the other day, but it was not for anything that I was going to eat.
Why not? If the components were biological, were carbon-based molecules, you could build a steak in your 3D. You could print a steak in your 3D printer and eat it. I think we're losing the audience.
Are we?
I don't know.
Okay, no. So,
now
so,
objectivism is certainly dead.
Oh yeah, no doubt. We put the nails on the coffin and
That's it. 3D printing steaks. That's it. Can't even.
That was command performance right there for JA565HR.
Yeah, but no, I'm a big believer in 3D printing steaks. So I can't wait.
So here's how I sort of. By the way, I've got some program notes over at don'tletitgo.com for people who want to check them out. The way that I would see then sort of the rest of the program that's fitting into our discussion is the different policy issues that we're going to talk about are the different ways that our politicians are not necessarily going to make us go extinct tomorrow, but are certainly working towards.
Well, and also presenting values that are not real human values. So that's also a connection. Let's just finish on this.
Mm-hmm.
This is nihilism. This is the real nature of the environmentalist movement, qua movement. This is why they should be despised. And in terms of human life and anything unhuman, barring intelligent aliens, anything human beings need to do is legit in order to survive, thrive, flourish, be successful at living qua human beings. So I don't buy into any of this. Yes, when you reach a certain level of wealth and you can afford not to have your animal suffer, cool, but that is by no means a primary and way, way down the road. Now,
we have 60s and 70s, people are saying, imagine all the people living lives in peace with no money and everything else. And now it's just imagine they're
there's
gone.
There's no people living on the earth. Yeah. Da 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 da. No, I shouldn't sing. I swear I would never sing on the show. All right, we got a bunch of super chat questions, so we're going to have to take these. Do you think above nuclear testing should be made legal again? There's solid evidence nuclear power could facilitate space travel. Quick answer, I'm a huge fan of nuclear power. Anything that would, but I don't think you need above ground nuclear tests to get better nuclear power plants. I don't think. But if you do, then yes, I'm for above ground nuclear power, nuclear testing, you know, in really safe places where people will never go to, and you can really, and I know that will devastate the ecosystem there. But I don't care. If
why can't
be,
we just copy the French? What's the testing to do nuclear power?
I don't know.
Oh, so let's nuclear power spaceships. Is that it? We need that?
Let's assume that to create a new nuclear power plant that you could fit into a spacecraft or into an automobile, or you would have to do above ground nuclear testing. I would say yes, but I don't think that the one necessitates the other. So just to do above ground nuclear tests for the sake of it, I'm against that. But again, you know, whose property is it and so on. But I don't think it's necessary. I'm all for nuclear power, though. All right, let's see. Yeah, best way to cut your carbon footprint is to die to zero, is to die, Jonathan says. Well, not quite, because Jonathan, because it turns out that when your body decomposes, you know, when the worms are eating you and all that, all those things are eating you, when you become one with Gaia, with Mother Nature, I think they emit CO2 in the process of decomposition. So you don't just have to be dead, you actually have to be decomposed.
The decomposition process itself. But, you know, that's a given anyway, right? So, I mean, no matter, we're here and we have no control over it, we're going to die. There's going to be that decomposition. So Jonathan's right. Just end it now and start the decomposition. If you really want to.
No. Too negative. All right. Jennifer asks, Dolly Madison saved paintings in the White House from the British in 1812. Okay. Another good example of somebody risking their lives to save art. Would you consider the philosopher intelligent by your standard, Your Honor and Amy? No. I mean, he's probably has a high IQ. He's got a PhD in philosophy. You know, there's some screening process. But intelligent requires some attachment to reality. I don't know. I don't think so. What do you think, Amy? I don't think so.
I mean, here's somebody who is a product of academic philosophy by which it's perfectly acceptable to take as a standard of value these different standards, and they're all talking within each other, you know, so they're not connected to reality, but they, you know, it's like someone who's really good at playing chess. Connected to reality otherwise.
Yeah, so I'd have to think about what intelligence means. If intelligence means the ability to manipulate data, to manipulate conceptual knowledge, I mean, I don't think he's very good even at that, because I think that he's got some obvious contradictions, logical contradictions in what he writes. And he's somewhat aware of them, and he evades them. So I don't know I'll have to think about what does it mean to say somebody's intelligent. So we'll get back to you, Gail, on that one. I need to think about it. I don't think he's stupid. I don't think he's an idiot. So I don't know if intelligent is the opposite of stupid. I have to think about how to use that term.
I'm wondering why we care.
I think she's just curious on how you use that word. I mean, we should care. It strikes me as just as much an important issue as whether pineapple should be in pizza or not. I mean, we're talking about definition
of words.
We're
deferring that, but no.
I'm baiting.
Whether this
I'm
guy
baiting
is smart.
Amy. I'm
I
baiting
mean,
Amy.
The question is whether he, I mean, maybe whether he's honest is something you would want to know, right? If you're going to evaluate him morally.
I think it's,
and
yeah. I think whether, it's interesting how we use the term intelligence, don't you? I mean, what is it actually capturing? What are we identifying in reality? And does this qualify? I think there's some legitimate issue there. Why aren't you convinced that the biggest expansion in credit history post-2008 will lead to the word recession in history a la Peter Schiff? I'm convinced. But when? How? How does it manifest itself? Is it the biggest expansion in credit history? Did that really happen? Do we know that, given that all that credit was held in reserve by the banks at the Federal Reserve as reserve currency? Do we know that credit actually expanded? It was the biggest expansion in history. You know, I don't think it was. Some forms of credit, but other forms of credit, you know, like bank credit. Anyway, the money didn't grow that much. If you look at all monetary measures, M1, M2, M3, didn't see much growth. So where did the credit go? And how is that going to manifest itself ultimately in a recession? And what does such a recession look like? And I think these are complex. I'm not going to answer right now. I think these are very complex issues. I think that it's very simplistic to say the Fed expanded the Fed pretended to expand the money supply by $4 trillion. Therefore, bad stuff has to happen. But the biggest expansion, therefore, the worst stuff that has to happen. That's not how it works, because where did that credit go? Again, if it went on the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve, did it create the kind of damage that we'd expect it to create? Maybe it created less damage. I think there is a reckoning coming. Will it be this coming recession? Will it be three recessions down the road? There is a reckoning for what happened after 2008, and we can list all the bad things that happened that will result in negatives in the future. But when and how it manifests itself, I think, is far more complex than Peter acknowledges.
And then here's my tie-in, right? So there's going to be this reckoning. Some bad things will happen. Maybe a lot of human beings will suffer. Maybe some will die. But if they do, it's just tragic. But in effect, it's okay, right? So, you know, if we are using these bad monetary policies to prop up a system that is conceded by everybody to be morally good, almost as something to contemplate like a human work of art or something, right? You know, that we have a moral system, then the fact that some human beings have to die in order to make that possible, well, you know, what is human suffering after all? Here we are as human beings.
Yep.
We are causing animals to suffer, right? So, you know, you could take some of these other issues here, right? The socialized medicine issue, right? We've got Donald Trump saying in a tweet, of course, but this is how he articulates so much policy. He says that he wants government to, quote, deliver great health care. What does it mean for government to deliver great health care? What is a system in which government delivers health care? It is socialized medicine. But, you know, everybody knows where that road ends. They've seen it. I mean, there was just some article the other day that somebody linked me to on social media. And it was like the 70th anniversary of the NHS in Britain and all the suffering that it's caused and deaths of human beings and stuff, right? With the wait list and everything else, all the rationing that this type of system necessitates. But hey, you'll have a beautiful moral system, you know, that Trump can point at and be proud of. Human suffering be damned, right?
Yeah, I mean,
doesn't everybody buy into this to a certain extent, right? It's like the new original sin or something, that human beings cause suffering. Not that we're inherently bad in the eyes of God, but we're inherently bad. We're staying on the planet, and the only saving grace, the thing that would make it a tragedy if we die, is either the art or, you know, if the great leader Trump can bring us towards a more moral healthcare system without these.
Yeah, I mean, this is where we always say, right? Morality trumps economics, morality trumps facts, morality trumps reality, morality trumps everything. And the reality of altruism says we should care for those who are sick, period. Period. You just should care for those who are sick. And if you have to sacrifice to care for them, so be it. If you have to sacrifice some sick people to care for the more sick people, so be it. Sacrifice is good. Sacrifice is noble if it's for the sake of those who suffer more than you. And notice what Donald Trump has said. The government deliver healthcare system. He wants the government. He's complaining about deductibles. It's true. In a universal healthcare system that is government provided, there are no deductibles. You go to the doctor and you don't pay anything out of pocket. He wants a government run healthcare system. And it's stunning to me, because we'll have people justify him and say, no, he's still the great savior of capitalism. when he is clearly in his, and he's targeting the tweets to Pelosi. Come on, let's get together with Republicans and give us a plan. Give us a replacement to Obamacare, something better than Obamacare, which means with greater government involvement. Let's sacrifice people for the sake of this moral ideal.
It was interesting because I sent this tweet out to him, is a great America one that has socialized medicine? That's what a system in which government delivers healthcare is, because that's the language he used, that he thinks government should deliver great healthcare. Yeah.
So Jonathan has this good comment, and then we'll keep going. He says, I imagine Jonathan Brezdik. I can imagine that much of this New York Times article would have made it into Ayn Rand's horror file. It is so explicit in its nihilistic and egalitarian premises. Yes, but she would have been horrified. I mean, if you think about a lot of what she had in the horror file, it was a lot more subtle than this. I mean, this guy, it implied human extinction. No. But this is 30, 40, 50 years later. Now, the intellectuals of our time, the philosophers of our day, are saying that in the name of morality, human beings should be extinguished. They should be eliminated. They should go extinct. In the name of morality.
Can they make that? Not only can philosophers today make that explicit in classrooms, in graduate seminars, but they can be published in the op-ed pages of the New York Times with that nihilistic stuff.
And on the east side of New York, New York, you know that there were a lot of well-off people opening up their New York Times and reading this up and saying, yeah, I mean, the suffering, yes, maybe human beings should go extinct. And then they went off to their Pilates and to their Whole Foods and to their jobs at Goldman Sachs and whatever and lived their lives.
So there was the funniest, let me see if I can find it, the funniest link, okay? Yeah, let me read this to you, because this is, I've got my screen open to New York Times, to this article, and you're reading it through, and sometimes they'll give you a link to something related that they want you to look at, right? So this is their link. They want you to go look at something else. This is what it says. It says, never be uninteresting. Read the most thought-provoking, delightful, and raw stories from the New York Times opinion section. You're supposed to read this, digest it, internalize it, own it, and spread the gospel that it might be tragic if human beings went extinct, but maybe it would be sort of good
die.
As well.
We
yes.
all die.
Don't be uninteresting. Make sure that you are well-versed in this.
Yeah. It's unbelievable, and I mean, there's a part of me that wishes Ayn Rand was around today, because she would be so sharp and so cool and so, she would crush these bugs. And then I think, I'm glad she's not around today, because it's so intellectually, philosophically, it's so much worse today. I mean, I don't think this kind of stuff was published in the 60s and 70s.
Well, the good is better and the bad is worse.
Yes, I think that's true.
So...
I think that's true. But anyway,
her ideas been more widely about.
Yep.
Yes, than they were in a lot of different circles, and she didn't used to get mentioned at all in New York Times, right? And now sometimes she is. So yeah, good is better, the bad is worse.
All right. What next?
Okay, so socialized medicine is one of the things. And then the other is that he's actually figured out a new euphemization. Euphemization, is that how you say it? Yes, euphemization for farm subsidies, right?
Yeah, what's it called?
And it is market facilitation payments. Now, what I call them is market fictionalization payments, right? Because it has nothing to do with the market and everything to do with redistributing wealth made necessary, if you could say it's necessary, by his tariffs.
Well, and by China's tariffs and other people's tariffs, which distort the market. But instead of complaining about the fact that people have tariffs to distort the market, he wants to double up on distortion. He wants to increase the distortion. He's raising tariffs, and then he's compensating farmers for the raised tariffs. And it's insane. It's economically insane. It's morally insane. it's politically smart, I guess, because he's buying the farmers off. So Congress just passed a, in addition to what Trump is doing, which is part of this, but Congress also passed a $867 billion farm bill. This is almost $1 trillion, almost $1 trillion. 80% of that is going towards food stamps. So 80% of the farm bill goes to giving people basically vouchers to buy food. Now, maybe that's because food is expensive because we subsidize it and we have tariffs on it, because you could probably grow a lot of the food we grow in the United States cheap overseas. And if you just imported it, we would have it cheaper. So I wonder how much this farm bill would, how much the food stamps need for them. Not that there is a need for them, really. I mean, put aside that whole question, but there's a need for them would go away if you didn't raise the cost of food by subsidizing it and by distorting the market and by having tariffs on food, which are extensive. But 867, 80% of then, now that the Republicans held back on voting on this bill because they said, oh, we're going to make it a work requirement for people to get food stamps, which is a little strange in an environment where they claim, Trump claims, that only 3.7% of Americans are unemployed. So basically everybody's employed. So why would you have a work requirement? The people who are not employed must be unable to work, right? But of course,
right,
the numbers lie. The labor participation rate is still relatively low. So there are lots of people who could work who are not working, but who are not looking for work. And if you're not looking for work, you don't count as unemployed. So if you're sitting in your mother's basement playing video games and not looking for work, you are not unemployed, according to the U.S. government.
So they want to have it both ways. They want to, on the one hand, demand a work requirement as if there's a need for that requirement, and then on the other hand, pat themselves on the back for the good labor statistics.
Notice that this bill would pass with about half of Republicans and all of Democrats. And so this is a Democratic bill that Donald Trump is behind, pushing, encouraging, and will sign. It's a Democratic bill, and I predict you're going to get a lot of Democratic bills now that the Democrats.
Oh, this I think he's kind of happy about this. Is, you know, this is him. This is Donald Trump about having to compromise with the Democrats. It's sorry, not sorry. That's him in a nutshell when it talks about, because he's eager to do this on a number of topics.
So, by the way, the farm bill is going to expand crop insurance, which is subsidy, to new crops. Barley and hops. We need to ensure that there's enough barley and hops, and
national security beer, right?
Well, yeah, the beer, and also the beer industry needs this, and also, you know, I think a lot of these things are used in order to feed those animals that then suffer. So, you know, he's actually increasing animal suffering by increasing the amount of barley and hops we have, and then it will also expand family farm subsidies to include. So there was something in the farm subsidies where the subsidy, you would subsidize you, and then it would also subsidize your children, your close relatives, because they were supposedly dependent on farm income, and farm incomes had dropped, so we're subsidizing the farms, so they would include your close relatives like parents and children. Now this is under Republican Congress, Republican Senate, and a Republican, this hurts, president, it will now be expand the farm subsidies to include cousins, nieces, and nephews.
Wow.
Anyway, farm bill, $867 billion. That's almost $1 trillion.
So this might be where the money that supposedly we're raking in from the tariffs, the money that he brags about how rich we are from the tariffs, it's going to go into stuff like this. I guess that's,
I mean, I don't know. I mean, Trump has got to be, I mean, he's approaching being one of, you know, I don't know. Anyway, I mean, it's just horrible. And the way he writes about it, the way he promotes it, and the way people respond to it is just terrifying me, because the people who used to be supposedly free market are now all excited about subsidies, and they're all excited about tariffs, and they're all excited about socialized medicine, because they'll kill Obamacare, because they so hate Obama that they want to kill Obamacare. They don't, you know, what's it going to be replaced with? Something worse than Obamacare. Oh, but it's Trump did it, so it must be right. That's what scared me.
I had somebody on Twitter, right? So I put that tweet out there, and then somebody wrote back saying, oh, so you're against a free market in healthcare, because they're assuming that whatever Trump is going to put forward is going to be something that moves us towards the free market.
No, but they know that's an invasion. It has to be an invasion.
Oh, no, it is. And so when I point out, you know, the language that he uses in his own tweet to this person, I get no answer, because that's the thing. When you show, look, this is Trump in his own words.
Doesn't matter.
What I'm looking at.
Doesn't matter.
You're not allowed to do that.
No, you quote Trump, you show video of him, you repost his tweets, and it doesn't matter. Facts don't matter. That's the scary part about Trump's presidency, is the way people respond to it. Now, somebody wrote here, well, it's terrible, but would have been better than Hillary. Maybe. But then if that's true, if you really think it's horrible, but Clinton would have been worse, join us in attacking him, because Hillary's not president. Trump is. And you got to attack the evil that he is doing.
And he is talking more and more openly about working with Democrats. You're going to get worse than Obamacare. Guarantee if they come up with something.
Yeah, the problem is, I mean, the good thing is that it's unlikely that even the Democrats could agree on something and then convince enough Republicans to vote for it in the Senate. I just don't see anything coming of this. Now, if the Supreme Court actually overturns Obamacare, which I don't think will happen, but let's assume that actually happens following this Texas ruling. If they got to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court ruled it unconstitutional, then they'd be forced into some kind of compromise. And then beware, it's going to be evil. It's going to be so bad. It's going to be much worse than Obamacare. Much worse than Obamacare.
Yes, definitely.
All right.
I was going to ask you what the latest is on this Patreon, because I am closing mine. I actually left up in the program notes the tweet with the link to my Patreon post about this. But after we get off,
well,
the
we
day,
should compliment Sam Harris. I mean, Sam Harris took a real big stand. He probably he generates, I think, close to $1 million on Patreon. So this is a huge hit for Patreon. Mm. If him and Jordan Peterson leave, I mean, Patreon takes a massive hit, certainly in the space of podcasts and videos and things like that. They are among the biggest, if not the biggest. Good for Sam Harris for doing it, particularly given he's a leftist politically. So he's opposed politically to a lot of the people, who are
B&B platforms.
So good for Sam Harris. This is why I like him, in spite of the fact that I hate him so much and other things. But I respect him, put him that way. I don't know what's happening. I'm trying to get on Star on, what is it? Something Star.
It's the platform that was mentioned in this video that I linked to by Dave Rubin and Jordan Peterson.
So
they mentioned it briefly.
Salgan Avocado's moved to. And but the problem is that they are flooded by people going in the platform. And I get constantly this message saying, your application is under review, but we're flooded. We'll let you know. It'll take longer than usual. And it's been days. Subscribe Star. So I filled it all in. It's there. I'm waiting for them to approve it. I am approved on one other platform, but I don't know. I don't know what it's like. So,
well, what about the platform that they're putting together, Ruben?
This is my
Peterson.
Concern. Neither one of them are tech guys. Now, they. My assumption is they're getting a lot of advice from tech guys, but I said this yesterday. I think that it's much more difficult than they think it is. I think it's going to take a lot longer than they think. Bitcoin, it's not like Bitcoin might be a solution for this to get around all these payment systems. There's a Bitcoin platform that they've been trying to get me to come on board. I think they'll solve it. But I think it's going to take longer than the week that Jordan Peterson said it would take. I expect this is months of work. I've been contacted by at least one tech guy who wants me to introduce him to Peterson and Dave Rubin so they can help. I'm excited about it if they can pull it all together. And then the question is, will it be a broad platform or will it be just –
and that was the question I had for you, which is, you know, would they welcome objectivists with open arms on?
Well, Dave would. I've already talked to him. So there's no question Dave would. Whether Jordan would, I don't know, but Dave would. And I think Jordan would. I think Sam Harris would. You know, I think they'd accept. But what are their standards going to be? Who's going to write them? None of this is easy. And this is my only defense of Patreon, Facebook, Google, YouTube, all of these people, is that none of this is easy. Now, given that, I think they're screwing it up royally, but it's not easy, and it's easy to screw up. So, and I'm not surprised they're screwing it up, given their philosophical standards. And given a world in which the New York Times publishes the kind of op-ed we just talked about, I'm not shocked at all that Patreon is finding it difficult to come up with objective standards for who should be on their platform or not. This is the world we live in.
And what do you say to the people? I've actually only heard really one or two people say this, that they were right, that Patreon was right in dumping Carl Benjamin off their platform. That
I mean the CEO
something bad, and then somebody was saying he regularly, I forget, like featured or something about gay porn, which I had never heard in my life. What is this?
So I don't know. I mean, look, the CEO of Patreon was on Dave Rubin's show when they deplatformed Law and Summers, and he said, it's only your behavior on the platform that matters. Now, I don't think that should be the standard, but that's the standard he set. And clearly it's not the standard they used on with regard to
Carl Benjamin,
to Carl Benjamin. The other thing is, I don't know what he did with gay porn. I can't imagine he was posting gay porn on YouTube,
like,
because YouTube wouldn't allow you. I don't know where he would post it. So I don't know anything about it. Look, Carl Benjamin is a gruff guy. He says stuff that I wouldn't say. He says it in ways that I wouldn't say. You say stuff in ways that I wouldn't say. I mean, you use the F word in ways that I don't.
Actually, I don't. I just post GFDA.
So there are differences, right? But no, I didn't want to compare him to you because there's no similarity. He is crude. You're not. He's crude, right? And I can understand a platform saying, we don't want crude people on the platform. And here are the standards. Okay, well, make it explicit. I haven't seen anything to suggest that Carl Benjamin violated their standards, or that there's – now, maybe I'm wrong. I'm not saying I'm not wrong. I'd need to see the proof. He used to tweet gay porn to people he didn't like. Okay. You know, I don't know what to say about that. I think that's horrible.
Silly, and I don't
get it. But I don't know why that would bother Patreon that much. And if – this is the question to ask. If a leftist,
I would never do that. But would I make that a criteria for banning someone from Patreon? No, I don't think so.
If a leftist did it, would they ban him? And I don't think so. So that's the problem I have with all these platforms. If they choose very strict standards and they ban a lot of different people, fine. But then apply those standards consistently and objectively. But I've seen where on Twitter somebody will use racial epithets, and they get banned, and other people use them and they don't get banned. And the difference usually is one is on the right and one is on the left. Now, you know, I think.
And sometimes that's because the people who are on the left are more avid in reporting users on these platforms. I have seen time again, those of us who are non-leftists, we don't report people because we don't have this idea that it's right to try to shut people off from speaking. You know, we mute them or block them.
Yeah, so would I take alt-right people on a platform I had? No. But I wouldn't take Antifa on the platform either. So I think alt-right is racist, despicable, horrible.
So here's the question, right? Isn't tech capable of having an objectivist platform, right?
Yes, but then only objectivists would be on it. See, we want to be, you want to be on a broad platform. You want to be a bit, but how broad is the question? Do you want a platform where there's porn? Do you want a platform where there's Nazis? Do you want a platform where they're communists? Do we want, you know, no. So how limiting do you want it? And I think ultimately they're going to be multiple platforms where they define it differently. And maybe one wins out because it's defined it better. But if somebody defines it badly, it's going to take a while for a replacement to come about because Facebook has, what, so many billions of people using it.
But the platform that serves the Patreon function itself doesn't necessarily have to be broad as long as you have other broad sources to funnel people there, right?
Yeah, I mean, Patreon is just a payment mechanism. Now, it's also a community in a sense that you post stuff there and you have a relationship with your
Yeah, and that's what I'm wondering is, like, how much is the broadness of Patreon really a factor, you know, versus, you know, Facebook, for example, where maybe you are funneling a lot of traffic to your Patreon or your Patreon.
I mean, if I were Patreon, I would definitely evaluate your different places that you're funneling people to Patreon. And this is the thing. So somebody's asking, can Sargon or anyone else hold them to their own terms and conditions? No, because... Yes, I mean, but the terms and conditions are written in such a way, and they have lawyers, they're smart, they're not stupid, and they basically have it written in such a way that says, these are the things that are unacceptable, and we preserve the right to decide who can be on our platform and who cannot.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have themselves an out, so that you can't sue
them. And so what you want to do is you want to plan long-term, and you want to say, can I, in the long-term, deal with these people? And this was a discussion I was having with some people. You know, when I posted this Patreon closing thing, it happened that Ben Shapiro retweeted it, which got it all this attention. And then people came in and said, well, you only had, you know, 60 some odd whatever patrons, and who are you? They don't care. And it was nasty. But one person was saying, well, if you're an objectivist, shouldn't you be in favor of a business like Patreon just whatever they want goes and everything? And I said, no, you know, there are standards of business ethics you know, that an objectivist would follow, that they would say, you know, we are going to put out a terms of service that is clear, that we follow consistently. So if we say that your manifest behavior on the platform, or what manifest observable behavior, if that's what we're judging you on the, you know, on the platform, we're going to do it. We're going to actually follow through with what we say, right? That's what a rational a business that was acting in a rationally self-interested way, that's what they would do. And that's the standard that any objectivist would want to, as much as possible, apply to deciding to deal with somebody like Patreon.
Absolutely.
And if Harris is, you know, applying that standard to them. He's saying in here, he says, that he doesn't consider it tenable to expose any part of his podcast funding to the whims of Patreon's Trust and Safety Committee. He sees them as not acting on any discernible, consistent rules or principles, but instead just acting on whim. And no rationally self-interested businessman would say, your livelihood is subject to my whim, but sign up for my platform.
Well, and there's certain businesses I wouldn't want to work for because they let's say they give raises on whim, or they're too political. They have a right to do that. They have a right to give a raise to whoever they want. But I don't want to work for them. I don't want to do business with people who pay on the last day when you invoice them, always on principle kind of thing. You know, I'd rather work in somebody who pays early, or you know, where there's an open relationship. Somebody there are lots of business practices that are legal and contractually legal, and yet you don't want to deal with it. So objectivism doesn't say, it's not whim worshiping. It's not libertarianism. In other words, it's not. It doesn't say we support business no matter what they do. Period. We say no. We want businesses to behave ethically. Ethically. Ethically means by the standards that ultimately lead to their profitability. But those, they are standards. They are principles. Mm-hmm. And they're very similar to the seven principles that for individual human beings. We want them to be, first and foremost, rational. We want them to be honest. We want them to have integrity, and so on. So,
and that's, I think, why people, too, can't understand people like you and me criticizing Trump, for example. Because, look, you know, he's a businessman, and he was a wealthy businessman. And
so was Owen Boyle. Owen Boyle was a wealthy businessman in Atlas Shrugged, and he was the villain, one of the villains in the book. I mean, the fact
he's doing some good things. And my, what I always come back is, whatever good thing that happened to come out of Trump you can't rely upon it because you don't see him as being animated by any sort of consistent principle. Similarly, here's Harris looking at Patreon and saying, I do not see this trust and safety committee as acting upon consistent rules in a way that I can predict and understand long term. And so I don't want to subject my future livelihood to this. And
I think that's right.
It's a very rational decision.
Absolutely. So I will drop Patreon as soon as I can, as soon as I have alternatives. By the way, the alternative right now, if you don't want to use Patreon, is you can use the Super Chat feature on YouTube to make your contribution right now or anytime I'm on live. Or you just go to PayPal, paypal.me/Yaron Brooks Show, and make a – you can't do a regular thing, but you can make a one-time contribution, and people have – I know a lot of people, I've seen a huge drop on Patreon, and I've seen a slight increase on PayPal, but I'm hoping more of those people who have dropped me on Patreon will come to PayPal and just give a contribution there until we set up an alternative platform, which will provide the same kind of perks, the same kind of advantages that Patreon provided.
Sounds good.
All right. Good.
So, I've just got a couple things there at the end. One is just Duran Duran, what happens tomorrow? Whichever way you happen to think about the human race, either that it might be a tragedy, but sort of good, and you're torn about whether the human race should go, you can listen to Duran Duran, what happens tomorrow? And little do you know, tomorrow the human race is going to figure out a way to survive and thrive and eliminate animal suffering and preserve the eat, right? So there's that. Or we could take your and my standard, your own, and we see politics and economics and everything. It's doom, but we just don't know when, and can the right ideas take over before the doom visits us and everything else? The Duran Duran songs for you too. And we don't have a show next week, so Feliz Navidad from Gwen Stefani this time. I'm on a Gwen Stefani kick.
All right, she's on a Gwen Stefani kick, and Merry Christmas, everybody. Merry Christmas. I don't think I'll see you before Christmas. So Merry Christmas, Amy.
Feliz Navidad from
Feliz
California.
Navidad, and that's right, I'm in Puerto Rico. I should do this in Spanish. I should do a whole show in Spanish. Thank you all for listening. Thank you for supporting the Yaron Brooks Show. Thank you for supporting Amy. And I'll be back, I think tomorrow. Amy, are you doing a show this week?
I doubt it. I'm going to do anything later this week. I'm gearing up for Christmas.
And then I have to figure out what my schedule will be next week with Christmas and everything. And my
I'll write you emails.
One of my sons
that
is visiting me here in Puerto Rico, so we'll see. We'll see what's going on. But
yay.
But tomorrow there'll definitely be a show, and maybe on Thursday as well. We'll see. And we'll try to, if you have topics you think are provocative, and the shows that do the best in terms of listenership is like when you put in the title Sargon of Akkad, or you put in the title Dave Rubin and Jordan Peterson. So if you have a title for a show that I can do tomorrow, which has somebody's name in it, like Niall Ferguson didn't work.
Shapiro.
Yes, Ben Shapiro.
Like, wrong.
So if you have a title with some content that I can do tomorrow, let me know, because I'm looking for a title that can take advantage of the name recognition of the person I'll be criticizing.
Maybe if you put Patreon in there, right? That
yeah,
is it, right?
Patreon's
it's
good.
A hot topic.
John Oliver. They want me to do John Oliver. The problem is humor is so difficult to critique.
Big tech something.
John Oliver. Maybe I'll go after John. I did. You know, I went after what's his name? Reich, Robert Reich. Carlson Tucker. I could
Carlson.
Make fun of Carlson. That's easy. You don't have to participate. You need to keep a good relationship with Carlson. I don't. He's not going to have me on. All right.
You never know what happens tomorrow, right?
You never know. All right, guys. Bye, Amy. Have a good night, everybody. Bye.
Good night.